Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, award-winning editor and writer Rachel Slade, dedicates her new book to all the people in the world who earn a living by making things. Her book is called Making It in America, The Almost Impossible Quest to Manufacture in the USA and How It Got That Way. It's about global politics, economics, and labor through the story of textile manufacturing. Rachel Slade explores how free trade deals have decimated towns across the country and focuses on a young couple in Maine who attempt to produce an American-made, union-made, American-sourced sweatshirt. She writes, by the 1960s, roughly one-third of the American workforce was unionized, and Americans made nearly everything they wore. In 2017, Americans spent $380 billion on apparel and footwear, nearly all of it made somewhere else. So what would it take to revive U.S. manufacturing? Rachel Slade writes about cities, politics, history, economics, and culture. She spent a decade at Boston Magazine as a design editor and ultimately as executive editor. Her latest book is called Making It in America, The Almost Impossible Quest to Manufacture in the USA and How It Got That Way. Hi, Rachel. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, it's great to have you. This is such an important book. You bring up so many crucial issues. And now that we're heading into an important presidential election, there's a lot of questions about where does this all go when it comes to especially the union organizing we're seeing across this country. So first off, what got you interested in these topics?
Well, exactly what you're talking about. You know, over my lifetime, I have watched our political climate change and our cultural climate change. And I was looking for answers as to why that shift happened. And I looked at it through the lens of manufacturing. I think the loss of manufacturing and the attendant loss of organized labor has really changed how Americans relate to each other and to the work that we do and to the things that we buy and wear and use every single day. And so I was looking for a way to make an argument that maybe if we had more material literacy, in other words, kind of understanding where our things come from, then maybe we would start to value more the idea of making things again and embrace that as a way to move forward as a nation.
It really is incredible to think about how much has changed over the course of 50 years. I mean, it's not that long ago that we made almost everything we wore. And now it's really hard to find things made in the U.S.
It's true, but it's not impossible. There are makers all around the United States who are dedicated to what they do and make beautiful things. But yes, I mean, we began offshoring, as many people are aware, back in the early 80s, really took off, of course, with the passage of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement in 1992. And the first industry to get offshored was clothing and textile manufacturing, but that was just the tip of the iceberg. And so that's why I wanted to focus on that industry in particular, because it was certainly the first and absolutely the most offshored of our industries.
You have an interesting story about what it was like when you talked with friends and colleagues about wanting to write this book and how people responded to the thought of bringing back or reviving U.S. manufacturing. Can you tell us about that?
Absolutely, yes, because this is an age-old story with me. I am one of those crazy people who always looks at labels and everything to find out country of origin. So I've been exquisitely aware of offshoring for decades. And that's really upset me because I feel very close to the things that I buy and wear. And, you know, the quality for me is very important. The things are made ethically is very important. So I always thought that this was top of mind for everyone. So when I started to talk to my friends, I'm here in Boston. I have many friends who actually teach and have gone to Harvard Business School, for example. And when I talked to them about my interest in bringing back manufacturing to the United States, of course, this was a couple of years ago, they just dismissed the concept out of hand. I mean, basically what they said was the horses left the barn. There's no point in bringing back. Other people are doing it better and more efficiently. Why should I care? And so that's what started me on this quest to first write the essay that opens the book, and then to understand, you know, what does it look like when people actually make things in America? How does that change community? How does that change our relationship to our things? That was the quest I went on.
And you write, with all due respect to our nation's business schools, there seems to be a disturbing lack of knowledge about how the American economy works. In the fourth quarter of 2022, domestic manufacturing contributed almost $3 trillion to the U.S. economy and employed nearly 13 million workers who earned an average salary of nearly $96,000. This might surprise people given that we don't hear much about domestic manufacturing these days. So what are people making in the U.S.?
Well, people are making a lot of things. The auto industry obviously is huge in the United States, and we actually do a lot of exporting, which is good. We're also obviously big into aerospace and aviation. Previously, the BBC mentioned how Boeing is trying to get into space transportation, which is good, I guess, as long as Boeing's doing okay. And, you know, we also do a tremendous amount of high-tech manufacturing. But what we have given up are some of the more basic things, the things that were easier to offshore. I think now, though, especially coming out of the pandemic, many more Americans are aware of how vulnerable we are when our supply chain is so dependent on foreign producers. And so I think that there is, since I started writing this book, a much deeper interest in where things are made, how they are made, and where the weaknesses are in the supply chain. My first book actually was about shipping. It was about an American shipping tragedy, actually an American, a modern shipping tragedy. And that's actually what first alerted me to how actually vulnerable shipping is, to global trade. And then, you know, compounded by the story of the pandemic, I think, all of us began to realize, hang on, wait a minute. What does it mean to offshore, and how does that make us vulnerable as a nation?
And this is so important. I think that we need to constantly revisit NAFTA and the effects that it had on this country and other countries, because when you really think about, there's so many reasons why Trump won in 2016. I mean, won the Electoral College. But one of the reasons is NAFTA. And, you know, as you write about in your book, so many communities were hollowed out. People lost jobs. Their pay went down. In many cases, the only option is, you know, the Amazon warehouse, Walmart, low-wage jobs. And so let's talk about this, because I think this is so important. And I just wonder what, you know, after doing your research, what do you think people need to be thinking about now that we're heading into this election? So it's worth remembering that, you know, you write about how it was George W. Bush's attempt at freeing the market between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. He was so confident that Congress would support his treaty that he demanded more than permission to negotiate. He insisted that all of America's elected lawmakers allow his agents to negotiate with Mexico and Canada behind closed doors. Once his appointees agreed on terms, Congress either had to adopt NAFTA in its entirety or kill the whole deal. And the gamble paid off. Few legislators, as you write, wanted to be, quote, freedom killers. And the Democrat majority Senate passed the treaty under Bill Clinton in 93, 61 to 38. So it's important to remember that it was a lot of Democrats were on board with this also. When you looked at the number of jobs that were lost, how communities have been decimated, what was it like doing that research in this political environment?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, thank you for reading that, because that was what was most shocking to me, was how, you know, in the late 80s and early 90s, as NAFTA was being crafted, there absolutely was a bipartisan itch that needed to be scratched, which was allow big corporations to offshore their manufacturing to Mexico and Canada, but mostly Mexico. They were eyeing Mexico because obviously you could hire people for just a fraction of what you were paying American workers. And that wasn't just because workers, American workers were unionized. I'm talking about ununionized workers as well. There was just this massive discrepancy in, you know, cost of living and what workers would expect from their employer. And so as soon as the gates were open, companies started sending all of their equipment to first Mexico. And then ultimately when China joined the World Trade Organization in 2002, we continued to offshore our equipment, our knowledge, everything over to China as well. So yes, one thing I think that's really interesting and the reason, part of the reason that I think a lot of Americans weren't really aware of this devastation that was going on in these towns is that a lot of towns, a lot of manufacturing was done on a fairly small scale in rural places. And so a town might be built around one industry, one company, one manufacturer. I use the example of Campbellsville, Kentucky, which was the base of Fruit of the Loom. And Fruit of the Loom in the early 1990s, before NAFTA, Fruit of the Loom employed something like 23,000 workers in that small town. And these were mostly women of color who made a respectable living making underwear for Americans. I mean, that's where it happened. When you bought underwear in America, believe it or not, it was made, much of it was made in Campbellsville, Kentucky. When they offshored, that's a whole town that was left without an industry, without a source of income, with nothing really. And so you have all these people who the rug is just pulled out from under them and they have no recourse. And this story repeats itself again and again and again until, you know, finally we reach critical mass where we have now a massive number of voters who have seen this happen in their own town and need to blame somebody. And, you know, so when somebody is speaking their language, like Trump did back in 2016 when he ran, it really resonated with the folks who had lost their jobs and were not able to recover. Mm-hmm. And by the way, this phenomenon is still going on. It is not over yet. So as I was doing this research, and especially as I was speaking to people who represented unions during that time, including my own protagonist, Ben Waxman, who founded the company up in Maine, and I'm sure we'll talk about him. You know, he saw this too. He was representing the AFL-CIO in very difficult places, in Ohio, in Wisconsin, in Pennsylvania, where these factories were shutting down so that people, so the corporations could make more profit. They weren't not profitable, but they were moving their operations overseas or to Mexico specifically to make more profit. And Ben Waxman was standing shoulder to shoulder with workers as they lost their jobs, as they lost their pensions, but even, I think, more importantly, as they lost their communities. Because as I said, these were, in many cases, you know, one industry towns. And so, yeah, it's heartbreaking. And I understand. I have incredible compassion for folks whose identities were wrapped up in this kind of work. And it's skilled work and it's generally well-paid work. And then suddenly it's gone. The anger, the sadness, I don't think can ever be properly expressed. And these were based, these devastating decisions were based on policy decisions. Like this was a policy decision to allow these jobs to vanish from our shores.
Right. And it, as you say, decent wages in many cases with benefits and a pension. And then all of that is taken from them and then what options do they have? You write that since NAFTA's implementation, more than 60,000 manufacturers in the United States permanently shut their doors. 5 million American manufacturing jobs vanished between 1994 and 2013. In textiles alone, more than 1 million manufacturing jobs evaporated between 1990 and 2019. So that's not that long ago. So can you talk about what has happened in the last, say, 5 years because of these trade deals?
Yeah, well, I mean, what can I say? The devastation continues. Eight textile mills have closed actually since September of 2023. So that was just what, wow. nine months ago, I'm going to say. And remember, these are not textile mills that are just making drapes or, you know, upholstery fabric. Like, we use textiles in everything, including the automotive industry, aerospace. You'll find textiles literally everywhere and in high-tech applications as well. So, I mean, it is really devastating what we're seeing and what continues to happen. Of course, it's not just a loss of jobs, which we can talk about, and we are talking about, but it's also the loss of capability in our nation to do very fundamental things, right? Which then builds our dependency on other nations to provide the things that we need to function, to survive, and to compete. The other issue, of course, is that when you produce, when you manufacture, then you can innovate. Innovation and manufacturing go hand in hand. I like to talk about, you know, the invention of the first computers here in the United States and operating systems. I mean, the people who developed these very high-tech things, of course, started, you know, in little workshops, maybe in their garages, like soldering motherboards together themselves. They understood how things went together. So, and using that knowledge, they could figure out how to improve upon these things. So when you make, you can innovate. When you lose that capability, you lose your connection to the possibilities.
Mm-hmm. Today, we are spending the hour with Rachel Slade. We're talking about her book, Making It in America, The Almost Impossible Quest to Manufacture in the USA, and how it got that way. She explores how free trade deals have decimated towns across the country, have brought down wages, what else this means for the U.S. and other countries, and focuses on a young couple in Maine who attempt to produce an American-made, union-made, American-sourced sweatshirt. And we'll talk about that later in the show. Some things are made in the U.S. We'll also talk about that during the show. But in some cases, it's hard to find. And so many people have gotten used to these low, low prices. But there is a very high cost to these low prices. So, Rachel, you have this amazing story in the book about what happened when, you know, buyers, corporate executives decided to go overseas. And I always thought, the United States is so obsessed with China. And yet when China is brought up, it's so rare that these corporate executives are asked, you made a conscious decision to shut down the factory in the U.S. and go to China. Can you talk more about why you did that, or Vietnam, or now Bangladesh? So you've got this amazing story in your book. Beth Macy, the journalist who wrote the book Factory Man, tells the saga of what happened here through a family-owned 100-year-old Virginia furniture business. In the early 2000s, the third-generation owner of Bassett Furniture Company, once the largest wood furniture manufacturer in the world, traveled to China to explore the possibility of shifting his manufacturing there. He toured facilities throughout the country with a Taiwanese fabricator. During one of these tours, the Taiwanese businessman confessed that he was confounded by Americans. He'd worked with buyers from all over the world, including Europeans, Asians, Middle Easterners, but said Americans' greed was beyond anything he'd ever seen. I had to read this section a couple times. I think it says so much. Can you talk more about this?
Absolutely. Yeah, that is such a devastating story. So what the Taiwanese businessman was saying was he couldn't believe that Americans were willing to export literally everything about their business. It was one thing to have Chinese manufacturers produce parts, for example, but to export lock, stock, and barrel, every single component, every single facet of a business to another country, and just basically offshore all the labor, was just astounding to him. Where was, he wondered, you know, Americans' pride in producing and supporting each other, in trade secrets? It was non-existent. And actually, I have a more modern tale along the same, and people keep making the same mistake, but Elon Musk, in order to get around California's labor laws during the pandemic, I believe, decided to set up Tesla manufacturing in Shanghai. And he recently said, well, yeah, now the Chinese know how to make, you know, beautiful EV vehicles, electric vehicles. And so, yes, eventually they're going to put me out of business. I mean, I'm paraphrasing, obviously, but that's basically the gist of what he was saying. And it's like, well, yes, what do you expect? and that continues to happen. And I think I think the problem generally with Americans, if I may, Americans, please excuse me, but here we have the evidence, is that, you know, we really do worship money and profit. And we've shown again and again that a lot of these exceptionally wealthy people are bad actors. I'm thinking about private equity, for example. I mean, the billionaires who are making so much money, we love hate them. I mean, we have incredible unmitigated admiration for people who are able to game the system and accumulate incredible wealth. And yet we continually also report on and moan the fact that, you know, there's so much devastation in their wake. I mentioned private equity because right now, again, I'm in Massachusetts. We have a whole health system. It's called Steward Health System. It involved 8 hospitals that were bought by a private equity firm, which completely gutted them. And so now we have all these hospitals, 200,000 workers, who are suddenly, you know, might be out of work, and communities that lack a hospital. And it's all based on greed. It's simple greed. So we see this again and again in every sector, which is why I have also noticed that unusual actors are starting to unionize. And I'm talking specifically now about physicians. I've noticed that physicians in these large healthcare systems are really starting to worry about the level of care, just mm-hmm. as nurses have been worried about the level of care when private equity and other bad actors take over the healthcare systems. And so they're fighting back. And I do see the push to unionize now among younger folks, but also among professionals, as a way to kind of claw back the power that's been taken from us and has reaped such harm mm. on the American people and our industries. So that's in a nutshell where my head is right now, and which is why I'm very focused on manufacturing. Because it's a very tangible way to track who is profiting from business. When you have manufacturing in the United States, obviously we have minimum wage laws, we have environmental laws, we also have the ability to unionize, which means the workers are protected and could get their fair share of the profits. But when you offshore, it means that you can pit factories against factories in very poor countries, trying to get the best deal, basically exploiting people all around the world to get the best deal, so that then you can reap even higher profits. But at what cost? So that's why I'm very much pro-American manufacturing, because at least if something is made in America, you have some assurance that people have been treated well, paid fairly, and that you're supporting American taxpayers who then pay back into the system that supports you.
Right. And then the money that you spend stays local in the community. And there's so many benefits to that, which we'll talk about after a break. But I want to ask you one more question, just because I've been thinking so much about this section of your book, that when the Taiwanese businessman would meet these Americans in China, he said that in addition to Americans' greed was beyond anything he'd ever seen. He said he'd never met people so hungry for profit that they were willing to export everything, not just their labor, but all of their manufacturing knowledge to reap bigger payoffs. And I just think, Rachel, you know, when you do see CEOs interviewed, it's mostly on the CNBC channels. Once in a while, public radio maybe, or other media outlets, but I rarely hear them asked about this. You know, why are you shipping these jobs overseas for the bottom line when you know the effects of all of this? I mean, it's just the fact that there's such an obsession with China, and yet these issues are hardly discussed in the larger dialogue.
Right. What you're saying is that the problem is homegrown, and we can point our fingers at China, but China is basically doing what Americans did for a very long time. So it used to be that we had a much stronger industrial policy. And that's actually a term that I wasn't really familiar with until I started working on this book. And our industrial policy actually went hand in hand with the founding of the United States. It goes all the way back to Alexander Hamilton and George Washington. So just a little bit of history, if you'll indulge me. We were, as a colonist, we were completely dependent on British imports of British manufactured goods, or imports carried on British ships. Like, that's why we fought the revolution in great part. I mean, we talk a lot about, you know, human rights or civil rights or, you know, taxation without representation. But ultimately, what we really wanted to be able to do was to, you know, trade and manufacture with abandon so that we could control our own economy. And so from the very beginning, we developed laws that would protect and grow American manufacturing. And all of these laws came out of Alexander Hamilton's report on manufacturers, which was delivered to Congress in 1792. And what he said has not changed one bit. You have to protect what makes you, you, for your national interest, for cultural reasons, for political reasons, to protect your people. You need to protect manufacturing. You need to support research and development. You need to make money available so that people can grow their companies. And you need to ensure that cheap imports stay out of the country so that you're not competing unfairly with other nations when you try to sell your goods.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. Today, we are spending the hour with Rachel Slade. Her latest book is Making It in America, The Almost Impossible Quest to Manufacture in the USA and How It Got That Way. And Rachel does have a list of products made in the US at her website, rachelslade.net. For example, Vermont flannel, organic cotton flannel, clothing cut and sewn in Vermont, ADKTD, California-inspired soft goods and hats made in California. There is a pretty long list here. So you can find products made in the United States, made by people who earn a living wage. And again, you can find that at Rachel Slade, SLADE.net. We'll also put it on our website, yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
Thank you.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we are spending the hour with Rachel Slade. Her latest book is Making It in America, The Almost Impossible Quest to Manufacture in the USA and How It Got That Way. Rachel, before we take emails and talk about what it takes to manufacture in the United States, I want to spend a little bit of time talking about the people who do make clothing overseas. We've done so many shows about this. And I appreciate also that you write about what happened under COVID. You write that when Americans and Europeans stopped buying clothes during the pandemic, major brands canceled orders with their small manufacturers around the globe. In April and June 2020, clothing orders worth $16 billion were canceled by major brands like Adidas, Gap, H&M, Nike, JCPenney. And this really, I remember reading about this, it hit mostly women around the world so hard. You write about Elizabeth Patron, who wrote a New York Times story about this. She described Ashraf Ali, a 35-year-old father and garment worker in Bangladesh who was desperate to feed his family. In Cambodia, garment worker Shokanthia Yi said she spends sleepless nights worrying about how she'll pay off loans and took out to build her house. I mean, in this case, these workers have no rights. And so when these orders were canceled, they were not bringing in any money.
I mean, that's one of the reasons why it's so cheap sometimes to manufacture abroad. It's very expensive to manufacture in a place where people are taken care of, such as they are in the United States, and the environment as well. Environmental laws, labor laws, reinforcing those laws, that's expensive. That's expensive for society. But these are the decisions that we made as Americans, that we valued how workers were treated, and we valued, obviously, taking care of the environment. So we created these laws, and then corporations figured out ways around them, which is obviously manufacturing abroad. So, you know, when you look at how inexpensive some of these things are, and I'm speaking now about, you know, all sorts of items, not just clothing, but everything. When you order it on Amazon, you know, direct from abroad, mostly Asia, the prices seem impossibly cheap. And if they seem impossibly cheap, it's because they are impossibly cheap. There are inherent costs that we have yet to pay for the decisions that we're making right now. Rose, if I could, I would love to just mention, you know, you talked about how you have this upcoming show on the modern Christian empire and the rollback of Roe v. Wade. And I wanted to mention that this is actually related, if you wouldn't mind.
Please.
So the rise of the right-wing Christian empire, as you refer to it, actually started back in the 60s or late 50s, early 60s. It was the moment when unions actually were working hand in hand, for the most part, with civil rights. Mm. A lot of people may not remember that the March on Washington, where Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his I Have a Dream speech, was actually made possible by the Amalgamated Clothing Workers, which was the Clothing Workers Union, and the United Auto Workers, which of course is the Auto Workers Union. They were the supporters of that massive March on Washington. And so you have unions and civil rights coming together, threatening to really transform, change the balance of power in the United States. And that's when you get the seeds of what we're seeing now, which is this counterforce, a very different force, which depends on atomization of voters, of Americans. And in order to get that atomization, you know, you have to remove the voice of the unions, because a lot of people forget, but unions aren't just about negotiating for better wages. Mm. They were also a major source of education for workers, especially like civics education. They were a source of information about politicians and policy and all kinds of things that would affect normal workers. So that was the counterbalance to, you know, the corporate interests. And so when you have such a reduction in people getting like having access to really good source of information that would support their interests, that's when you start getting this transformation in the cultural landscape and political landscape in America.
Thank you. I mean, that history is so important. And I guess it's a good time to ask you now, and then we'll talk about the Waxmans. And we have a number of emails. When you think about what is at stake in this upcoming election, with you know, the possibility of Donald Trump taking power again and going much further than he did in 2016, what are your thoughts about all of these issues that you focus on? Manufacturing in the United States, organizing, unions, living wages. Can you just talk about what is at stake?
Everything is at stake. I think what's frustrating for me is that I have actually seen what Biden is doing. And I've worked with people who are working with the Biden administration to restart manufacturing. And here's what is happening right now. In order to become more environmental, right, we need to get solar and wind online in a big way in the United States. But in order to do that, in order to replace the fossil fuel infrastructure, we need to build a massive new infrastructure system. And so the Biden administration is exquisitely aware of this. And so they've put out this incredible series of policies that are designed to stimulate manufacturing of a green infrastructure, everything from, you know, solar panels to turbines, but also to the electrical grid, which really, really needs to be upgraded so that we can switch our power from fossil fuels over to electric. And it's an infrastructure package on a scale of which I've never seen in my lifetime. But it takes time because these are public-private partnerships, because that's what our world is, right? That's the United States. It's always public-private partnerships. And so this is a grand gesture, a grand move to refocus manufacturing in America and to get this infrastructure built here in America, while also ensuring that a whole new generation is trained to build this stuff, service this stuff, innovate. Anyway, it's a massive undertaking, and the Biden administration has put real power behind it. And for some reason, that message just isn't getting out. And maybe because it's wonky. I mean, I get it. Look, when I say infrastructure, I don't know if your eyes roll back into your head, but here's what we're talking about. You know, people are tired of fossil fuels. We know the damage that they're doing to this world. There is an alternative, so we need to build it. And the question is, who in America is going to build it? How are we going to get it done? And that's where the Biden administration is. They have created a policy to get this going. We need to put faith in some of that. It takes time. I think 4 years is pretty short for an administration. I think at least $100 billion of private money has actually been invested in this endeavor. And we have to allow this to play out. I'm not even talking about, you know, the other political ramifications if Trump were to take over. I mean, it's horrifying. But I'm focusing right now on very important stuff that actually needs to get done, which is, you know, the building of infrastructure, the tariffs now. There are more tariffs to slow down, as I mentioned, the importation of cheap goods from abroad so that American manufacturers can compete here at the same level. We can level the playing field and create more demand for American goods. Like, these are the things. I am very sympathetic to the Biden administration. I feel that they have come into this problem with eyes wide open. They saw why people were angry. This is the first Democrat administration, I think, in a long time that really feels the pain that workers felt as they lost their jobs and is doing something about it. But I think it's either too slow or there are voices that are much louder that are just drowning out some incredible things that are happening in our country. Mm.
Today, we're speaking with Rachel Slade about her book, Making It in America, The Almost Impossible Quest to Manufacture in the USA and How It Got That Way. I wish we had another hour because this show has gone by so fast and we have a number of emails. So let's go to a couple of these. Hiroko writes, I ran a sustainable sewing collective in Oakland, co-founded Oakland Makers, and was asked by the San Francisco Longshoremen's Union to create a textile art that commemorated the 100-year anniversary of the New York Triangle factory fire. Wow, that is amazing, Hiroko. Amazing. Hiroko writes, thank you for the show. How can we move our consumerist mindset to understand the true cost of making textiles offshore?
Oh, Hiroko, thank you so much, first of all, for what you have done. Bravo. Yes, and that is part of the question, isn't it? It's very difficult to resist the cheap things coming in. I completely understand, which is why they're actually one of the ways that we are addressing this is, as I mentioned, is to level the playing field. There is a law called de minimis on the books right now that allows packages that are valued at $800 or less to be mailed directly from country of origin into the United States without any sort of tax or tariff. So that means that you've got stuff coming in, again, impossibly cheap. And in the case of Shein, for example, which is just a massive Chinese company exporting stuff to the United States, that means, and by the way, valued at $60 billion, this is a very young company.
Wow.
That means that millions of packages are being air freighted, per day from China into the United States without any tax or tariff. And so the stuff, again, I mentioned impossibly cheap. Why is it so cheap? Well, experts have linked the clothing that is being produced by Shein and others to the Uyghurs, who are the Muslim minority population in China that have been shown to be enslaved. And so it's interesting that a lot of people, and I know you are too, of course, naturally focused on the plight of the Palestinians. Here's another Muslim minority group that actually is enslaved in China, producing the cheap dresses, jackets, t-shirts that people in America are buying. I mean, yeah, I don't think enough of those stories are coming out. We see them, we forget them, we need something, we buy it on Amazon or through Shein or whatever it is, and we just aren't feeling those consequences, which is why I think we need to roll back this de minimis law so that at least we can start to tariff these things so that at least they get a little more expensive to stem the tide. I mean, one thing that I also want to mention is that, you know, Americans buy in volume. They're not buying quality. And this is not my judgment. This is experts, you know, just looking at buying patterns for Americans. You know, when one sweatshirt will do, people have dozens. I'm guilty of this too. Like, I have too much stuff. But they're spending the same amount of money that they always have on clothing, but they're buying in volume.
Well, thank you, Hiroko, for the email. Hiroko also writes that the 25th Street Collective of Soft Sewn Goods, a 7,000 square foot makerspace, was active for 7 years in the creative economy in uptown Oakland, and then they got a 48% rent increase. Wow.
Oof.
Yeah, that's another issue. Hiroko, thank you for writing. A related question from a listener who says, I see Amazon trucks in my neighborhood every day. What can we do to convince people to stop buying so much stuff and stop buying online? And I think this is really interesting because so many people got used to this during the pandemic, buying things that they never would have dreamed of buying online. And because it's easy, It's just people do it without thinking. I mean, I have people in my family who do it. We're all connected to this. And you write about, I mean, the numbers are so hard to wrap your head around. I mean, you start your book about what happened in LA when there was a backlog of these shipping containers. Each ship was an enormous floating warehouse packed with more than 7,000 shipping containers with all of this stuff coming from overseas. We could talk a whole hour about just how much stuff comes here every day, the cardboard, the trucks on the road. But what do you think it would take to change the thinking around this? Because so much changed under COVID.
That's so true. And look, I'm guilty of it too. There are days when I'm just like, screw it. I'm just gonna order it on Amazon. I can't go out. My background is in architecture and urban planning. And so, of course, there are consequences to ordering online. When I think about what's happened to San Francisco recently and your downtown, I mean, part of the gutting of that is just because, you know, we're doing a lot more online work and online shopping. I don't blame online specifically. What I blame is, of course, offshoring, like just the race to offshore, the race to profit, and also just the utter lack of interest in safeguarding American businesses that manufacture here. There were ways that we could have done it. This is a policy decision that we didn't. And so we're going to need to claw back laws that will actually probably affect pricing for a lot of Americans. And so they're going to have to buy less. I mean, there's no world, I don't think, that doesn't, you know, have to use both carrot and stick to get people to do the right thing. You know, it was very difficult to get people, but we do know, hang on, I'm not going to go there, but I am going to say that, I mean, humans, the reason that we have survived so long is because we are incredibly flexible and adaptable when push comes to shove. We do find ways to survive. And I think in this case, there needs to be a major correction. And fortunately, it is going to be both carrot and stick to slow down our consumption of cheaply manufactured things from abroad and to shift our focus to our neighbors and our friends and our communities where things are being manufactured locally.
We have just a minute left. I'm so sorry. We'll have to have you back because we didn't even get to talk about the Waxmans, Ben and Whitney Waxman, who started American Roots. And they did. I mean, they figured out, although it was really, really hard, how to produce an American-made, union-made, American-sourced sweatshirt. I mean, the story you tell about the fabric that unraveled because of the quality of the fabric, I just thought, oh my gosh, these poor people. But in about a minute, what did that experience and diving so deep into what they went through, what did that tell you about the prospects of reviving U.S. manufacturing?
Oh, it's such a beautiful story. And it's almost good that we didn't get to talk about it so that people can please read the book because I think it's one of the first books that really examines like what it takes to manufacture in the 21st century. But what's beautiful about the story, their story, is how profoundly they affected the community. They created something from nothing. There was no manufacturing in their community, that kind of manufacturing in their community outside of Portland, Maine. And then suddenly there was because of them. And through their efforts, because they created jobs out of nothing, they have lifted 75 families out of poverty, not just people, but families. Like the impact of bringing manufacturing just spins out everywhere because those families then support other families, right? Locally by buying things and seeking services. And then on top of that, you mentioned this a couple of times, but their products, the Waxman's products are all American sourced, which means they're creating demand for American manufactured goods. And so what goes around comes around. This is what we need to do. Every time a manufacturer sets up in one sector or another, they're starting to rebuild these ties. They're starting to rebuild demand for domestic production. And ultimately, that's going to help Americans feel better about ourselves and also strengthen our politics and our culture.
It really is a beautiful story, especially learning about how so many people who are brand new to this country were trained and felt respected. They were treated with dignity. I mean, it's so beautiful because it's just, we know that that's not the case in so many stories. So, Rachel, thank you so much for writing this book. And we'd love to have you back. I just want to mention one more email. Winifred writes, I've worked at Heath Ceramics for 50 years. We've been making ceramics locally in Sausalito since 1948. We recently became a B Corporation and we do tours. So nice. And when you think about it, how many cups do you really need? And if it's just the quality is really great and the money staying in the area, I think that's the question we all have to ask ourselves. So thank you so much, Rachel. It's a great book. We'd love to have you back.
Thank you so much, Rose. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Rachel Slade writes about cities, politics, history, economics, and culture. Her new book is Making It in America, The Almost Impossible Quest to Manufacture in the USA and How It Got That Way. And you can learn more about Rachel and read more about her work at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering today's show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.